direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh my God, we're live. Hold on, everyone. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am, of course, your host, Billy Masters. And today, thank you, Monica. Today is Thursday, June 10th. Now, as you can see, I am back in the studio. Tuesday, we were down at the beach house in Fort Lauderdale, and I had said that I would be doing both shows from there. I lied, although I really intended on staying in Fort Lauderdale a lot longer this trip. But, you know, last minute things change, and you're on a plane. And you know what's interesting is it's something that I have in common with today's guest. I was reading his book on the plane. Oops, I hit my mic. Like Crazy by Dan Matthews, Life with My Mother and Her Invisible Friends. We'll get to that. Which is a great book, by the way. And if you are stuck on a plane, well, actually, it's a good book for being stuck on a plane. It's a bad book for being stuck on a plane because you really better not be on a transcon flight, because even savoring things, it's such an engaging fast read that it's not going to take you cross country. And you know, this is one of those books that I love for the summer. I love books that can really capture your attention, and you can pick up a little bit later and you can read a few chapters and then throw in your beach bag. You can read it on a trip. You can read it on a beach. You can read it in bed with the one you love. And you know, it's funny. I'm actually looking in the book and, there's a napkin from American Airlines that I was using as a bookmark. I didn't have a bookmark. By the way, paid retail, just letting you know. Now, they would have sent me the book. They would have sent me the book, but I really wanted to make sure I got it before today's interview. And, you know, happy to pay retail for Dan Matthews. I think of myself as a very difficult person. Certainly a difficult person to be friends. Well, not a difficult person to be friends with. I have great friends. I have long-standing friendships with lots of people. But a difficult person in terms of, you know, a really deep one-on-one relationship, because my life is so chaotic. And as I said, I was supposed to be in Fort Lauderdale for a week, and then I woke up and I had to get out of Fort Lauderdale. I say, oh, I'm going to do this. But then, you know, I am the type of person that if somebody calls me up and says, what are you doing Saturday? There's a great party in Venice. I just get on a plane and go to Venice. And I think that's very difficult. And until reading this book, I had absolutely no idea that Dan Matthews is just as difficult. And yet he has figured out a way to make it work. This is the book, a good version of it, Like Crazy. And I am thrilled to welcome somebody who I've known for a very long time, but I think the longest conversation we ever had was backstage at a Go-Go's concert at Mandalay Bay maybe 6 years ago. But God knows what I'm in for now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Billy Masters Live, Dan Matthews.
Hey, Billy. Thank you so much for having me. And I loved your theme music. It reminded me of the music from Escape to Witch Mountain with Kim Richards, that
yes.
Disney movie from the 70s.
Oh, my God. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Yes, it put me just in that frame of mind.
Well, I want you to be
levitating across my living room now as a result.
Well, wait. Am I seeing the lights on the stairs?
Yes.
Because I've seen pictures of the house, which is vividly described in this book. You know, in a way, the first half of this book is a sort of a what to do and what not to do in buying a home. And I really identified with you because you at one point here, you have this great house in Virginia. What city?
Portsmouth, Old Town Portsmouth.
Okay. And you bought it in the winter of 2008. And when you're looking into refinancing, you're like, you're told, oh, you got it at the worst time.
Yep.
I purchased my condo in Fort Lauderdale January of 2007. It wasn't any better. And when I went to refinance, I was told the same thing. So what did you learn about, you know, if you're looking back now, what did you learn about buying a home if you were going to do it all again today?
Well, I wasn't buying it for myself. I was buying it to move in my 78-year-old mother. And the I can't have any regrets because this is the only house that I could find in Old Town Portsmouth that had a downstairs bedroom. My mother wasn't able to do stairs at that point. And Old Town, which is where I'm sitting right now, is the most wonderful, wonderful, historic little village that I could ever hope to live in. It's right across the harbor from Norfolk. We have a Deco movie theater, which is showing Cruella right now. We've got coffee shops. We've got bars. We've got two Mexican restaurants, two Thai places. Just the library is around the corner. There's a ferry that has run since the 1600s across to Norfolk. And I bought the house to move my mom in for her final years, and she wasn't able to drive anymore. So I had to have a place here in Old Town so that she could putter around on her walker or with her cane and not be stuck in the suburbs as she had been before. And so,
and not deal with stairs,
and not deal with stairs. Exactly. So, you know, I have no regrets. Here I am in the house, 13 years later. And I have, no regrets. She lasted 5 years and I am overjoyed that I got this place for her to have her first home as well as my first home. and you know, so many surprises came about after I moved her in. You know, she had always been a bit nutty. She was always very, very maverick with her social and political views. I grew up in Southern California in the 70s, was gay bashed in school all the time. She was always so pro-gay. When I came out, or when she helped me come out when I was like 13, she brought me to Goodwill to find a pair of pumps to go to Rocky Horror at midnight and brought all of my friends who weren't old enough to get in either. She told me that I was a part of this artistic elite of human beings and that I was not an outcast. And I mean, I was an outcast because I was a punk rocker and all that too. But she said that I should never look at myself as less than, but as more than, because there's something extra when you're gay. You have an extra sense about the world and an extra sense of humor and an extra sense of style. And so even though she was crackers a lot of the time and she had a lot of meltdowns, the fact that she, I have a lot of friends who had to reinvent themselves in the, after college in their 20s, because their parents or their church or their communities, their friends were so anti-gay that they could never come out until after college. I never had to reinvent myself. I was always able to just be me because of my mom. So when she was going off the skids, she in fact had, you know, lived at one point in a Salvation Army. And I, you know, having worked for PETA for years and years, always was happy to be in an apartment, and a one room apartment, but bringing her in to this house was just a logical thing to do. She always instilled the animal rights values in me. We brought in stray cats, got them fixed, kept them.
Yeah, brought two with her cross country.
Yes, she brought two with her cross country. And, you know, I was always a gadabout. I have spent, you know, the 80s, 90s, 2000s flying all around the world, you know, helping establish animal rights as a movement and putting PETA on the pop culture map with the Rather Go Naked Than Wear Fur campaign and all of these, you know, nonstop gallivanting, that it was weird to kind of settle down.
There you are.
I miss getting arrested, especially naked.
I miss you naked, so that's okay. We both miss things.
But so she, you know, when she was on her way down, it was a big, I am not really so much a family person. I love my brothers. I love my nieces and nephews. I love my father. My stepmother is still with us, Joan. I love her. But I'm not really so much a family person. I'm like an individual who loved living in a one-room studio and running around. So making the decision to move her in was tough. But, you know, when I thought about the fact that so many of my friends who contracted AIDS in the 80s and 90s, whose own parents stopped talking to them, a lot of coming out in the 80s and 90s was coming out and saying that you had AIDS. And I had so many heartbroken friends because his own families wouldn't deal with them. My mom would move them in with her. She would move in with them to care for them. She was always like this, you know, punk rock Florence Nightingale. And so I just thought, who's going to look after her? She's been there for everyone. And even though she's cuckoo, I can't just turn my back. So I took a deep breath, moved her in. The stock market recession crashed just a few months later, and over my head, underwater, but no regrets. It's just,
and a backyard underwater at a certain point, but we'll get you this. There's so much you brought up. So, you know, I have a, you know, you talked about that. You and I have lived very similar lives. You for a purpose, me just for pleasure, but we've really, up until a certain point in your life, you were not really beholden to any person. You could do what you wanted, which is a great life. There is a trade-off that you don't get, which is, as you said, the family, the roots, things like that. So I'm curious, right now in your life, do you consider yourself happy?
I consider myself overjoyed.
Good.
I am really lucky because, you know, as you know from the book, just when I hit the lowest level, having bought the house and moved in, my mother, who I didn't know at the time, she hadn't been diagnosed yet as schizophrenic. And I'm not handy. I can't fix things, you know, for me. And
that
my
was
mom,
surprising to me. The fact that you are so helpful.
Yes, a screwdriver is a cocktail, not a tool for us. So we were just like, but probably 6 months, 8 months after I got the house and moved her in, I met my future husband, Jack, at last call at an old, now flattened gay bar in Norfolk called Skip's. And he had just separated from his wife and had four kids and was coming out. And he had been adopted, and he had a large Catholic military family that was not conducive or open to gays. So he had remained in the closet for his entire life. He was coming to terms with coming out and coming out to his family. And he was in the lowest point emotionally at his life. I was in the most frantic point at my life. And my mom, she grew up in foster care and orphanages herself. And she instantly became the pro-gay parent that Jack had never had.
Well, that you both really needed.
We became this trio in this house. And, you know, Jack was living in a furnished room over in Norfolk. So within a year or so, he moved in with us. And Jack is a production designer for indie films. He did The Men Who Built America for the History Channel. Right now working on season 11 of A Haunting. They film a lot of things here in Virginia because it's beautiful locations and cheap.
And he's handy.
And he's handy and he's handsome.
Yes, he is. And by the way, here's a little wedding picture, which we'll get to that. But you did eventually marry in Vegas. As you said, you wanted to be you wanted to get married when you had the chance to be married in the tackiest place on earth.
Yes, it's true. I actually was always against marriage from my punk rock outlook. Like, I don't need the church or the state to validate my relationship. Jack wasn't so interested in getting married because he was married for 19 years already and had only recently got divorced. But when we saw all of the hate being espoused, especially by the Mormon-led groups trying to make gay marriage illegal in so many states, and then we really looked at our situation, Jack and I, the only thing we had was the house.
Right.
We had nothing else but this house, which was we were struggling to put together. And now, since Jack is a production designer, he has the same thrift shop sensibilities as me, and it's a really, really cool place, as you say, as described in the book. But we were able to make this. If anything happened to me, the house wouldn't really be his because we weren't married. There'd be in all these taxes and
right.
And so we thought, you know what? Even if we're not into the whole marriage thing, we shouldn't be penalized for not being married. So why don't we do it, but do it in a really fun way. And so we said that as soon as gay marriage would be legal is in Nevada, we would have as tacky a wedding as any straights. And lo and behold, you know, 3 months after we said that, Virginia ruled against the gay marriage ban, and 11 other states attached their rulings to Virginia's, including Nevada. So all of a sudden, it was legal to get married here in our home state of Virginia and in Nevada. And, you know, I work with PETA. I've worked with a lot of artists over the years. Chrissy Hine from The Pretenders. We've worked together since 1980. and she adores Jack. And she called me right after the news broke about Nevada. I was in the bathtub. She called and said, hey, we just have our final tour date set in America next month. And we're actually playing in Las Vegas on Thanksgiving. And I know how much you love that tacky ass town. Why don't you and Jack come and we'll have a little vegan Thanksgiving dinner in Vegas? And I said, we're coming all right. And we're going to get married. Would you be our best man? And she said, oh my God, are you kidding? Can my band play? And I was like, well, we don't need that. She said, well, I'm going to be there with, I mean, we might as well, at least the guitarist. And so then Pamela
Anderson. And let's bring Pam. Why not?
Pamela Anderson was still, she was still married to Rick Solomon at the time in Vegas.
Oh,
and
wow.
And so she was living there at the time. So I called Pam and said, okay, you're not going to believe this. You know, with the recent gay marriage ban overturned in both Virginia and Nevada, Jack and I are going to get married on Vegas on Thanksgiving. Chrissy Hynde's going to be our best man. Would you be our maid of honor? And she was overjoyed. And she came and was not only maid of honor, she wore such a sexy outfit that the Daily Mail called her the maid of dishonor.
Hello. Wow. And the first time I met you, we've talked about this. The first time I met you was with Pam and David LaChapelle.
Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, yes. You have a very eclectic group of people around you who, you know, not only do they love you and Jack, obviously, but they love your cause. You are the senior VP of PETA. You were one of the really one of the people who pushed the agenda to the point that the press actually got a hold of it. So why wouldn't your wedding also be a political statement?
That's kind of how we felt. And, you know, the fact that it was Thanksgiving and we had the reception at a friend's animal sanctuary afterward, and it was, you know, all vegan. And we talked about all of that when we got married. Funny enough, I was kind of excited about getting married in one of the tacky wedding chapels. Mm-hmm. And I called the first few that I called, the people who answered said, the gay marriage has been, banned and overturned. It's probably going to be banned again. We're not doing that sort of thing here yet. Oh, we don't know if it's going to stick. And after two calls like that, I just thought, fuck it. Who needs a wedding chapel? Let's do it in the middle of the street under the Welcome to Las Vegas sign. Of some of my friends, Connie and Gail, brought fake casino chips to throw instead of rice. It was a busload of Japanese tourists, and it was almost like a flash mob scene. We did it so you know, not last minute, but within the last week or so, it was all pulled together. And we didn't invite our families because it was Thanksgiving, and we didn't want them to feel like they had to cancel all of their plans and travel to Las Vegas, which can be costly at Thanksgiving. We thought that was very presumptuous of us, would have been presumptuous of us. So we didn't call them. We just figured we'd tell them afterward. Well, right. As it turned out, it was on Fox News and on all the media, because it was one of the first public gay marriages in the marriage capital of the world after the ban was overturned. And so it was big news. And our poor family saw it on the news before we could call and tell them, which put us in a little bit of a bind, but they understood when we explained, you know, how it all went down. And it was pretty wonderful. And that's, you know, obviously you read that in the book. So like crazy, it's a tale of what the fuck do we do with our parents when they are no longer able to look after themselves? What are our responsibilities? All of us are in a different position. I know that in America, we treat seniors like discarded cigarette butts.
Oh my God. And say, I did not know this. You listed like five countries, what they do with their elders. Could you share with the people? Because it was staggering to hear. If my mother ever complains to me what a terrible son I am, I'm going to tell them what they do in these other countries. So go ahead, tell people.
Well, I find, when you're reaching that point, obviously, you know, there's states in the U.S. now, like Oregon, and other countries like Holland and others, where you have a right to death kind of laws where you can choose to bow out with medical assistance. In other countries, like in Tamil Nadu, they will bathe seniors in a bath with fragrant oils and lethal oils that smell good, but they ain't coming out alive. Of course, in Japan, they used to walk long, long ago, walked their elders into the mountains. In Alaska, of course, the Inuits would famously, in olden times, set them adrift on little ice floes. So I was researching about all the different ways people have dealt with their elders, and I couldn't help but list them in the book as like, okay, that's not an option. That's not an option.
And we're not bad.
We don't have ice floes in Virginia. It's too hot. Global warming is taking care of that. Yeah. I can't leave her in a mountain because there's so many hiking trails in Virginia that her body would have been found before we had the after party. There was just, you know, it's a kind of offbeat take on, well, this is our responsibility. This is my responsibility. My brothers and I had all taken turns looking after her over the years.
Yeah, you had mentioned that in the, I guess it was the 90s, she was with your brother in California. And it was kind of like, okay, now it's your turn to sort of step up because you were working for Peter. You were sort of in a home base. You weren't globetrotting quite as much. So it was kind of serendipitous for your time of life and hers.
Yeah, and it was a decision. I mean, I still traveled after I moved her in, but what I found was Old Town being such a phenomenal place. It's a blue collar town. We've got the Navy base, we've got the shipyards. So that means there's a lot of stripper bars, a lot of tattoo artists, a lot of ex-cons,
all neighbors.
Neighbors. Yeah. And so my mom always was very social. She was, you know, she said she always wanted to be a fag hag, but never had social skills. She always loved being around around gays and interesting people. So when I moved her in, I knew that it wouldn't be like, okay, I'm moving in my 78-year-old mother. Now I can't have wild parties. And no, I knew it wouldn't be like that at all because she was still very vital socially and intellectually. So she told me from the get-go, I want to still meet people. And even though I'm too pathetic to go out, please bring people home from the bars so that we can have last call and interesting conversations with whoever you meet here at the house. And maybe they'll be able to fix something too.
Oh, and let's go back because before she even moved in, she was brought out to California by your friend. Was it Diego who brought her out?
Yes.
And okay. Yes. So Diego had previously been an escort.
He was at the time too.
Oh, he still was. Yeah. Okay. Could you please tell everyone what your mother said when you told her that he was an escort?
Sure. Sure. So I've been with Jack 13 years now. We've been married, I think five, something like that. But before, in the early 2000s, I went out for several years with a guy, Diego, who supported himself as a hustler. And a sweetheart, and not, I couldn't really
tell. And the first time you had sex was in the Imperial Palace, where I stayed married many times. Was it? Did it have a room with the love tub? Because that's what they were famous for.
No, the air conditioning didn't work that well, and so I know it was a really. I remember it being a very sweaty night. but I was there to lead a protest against fur at a big fashion event. And he was there to work it. He had some clients in Vegas. And each of us had met at a bar in Vegas after we had each gotten off. And just kind of fell for each other and lasted for 5 or 6 years. A lot of my friends knew what he did. I couldn't tell some people. However, my mom was really close to him. And when I finally told her how he supported himself, she said, "Danny Lee, don't you ever refer to Diego as a hustler. Just say that he's in real estate and manages a very large rental property."
I mean, I think that really says that was like the crux. That's because it's near the beginning of the book. And that's when I said, okay, that's who this woman is.
Oh, yes.
Which is the cool mom that, you know, everybody likes. And, you know, wants to sort of be part of the group in that people don't look at as a mother. They look at sort of as an eccentric or a kooky old lady, which is fun. Now, at a certain point,
it's very much like Estelle Getty in The Golden Girls. Right. No filter, no filter.
Right.
She was living in this kind of senior, it wasn't a senior home. It was an apartment filled with lots and lots of Christian seniors. And she was an atheist. And so it drove her nuts. And we were in the elevator there once, and there was a woman with her older woman with her Bible, and my mom and me, and I'm 6'5", And the old woman next to my mom looked up at me and she said, "Oh my, you're so tall. You must have to get on your knees to kiss the girls." And my mom said, "He's gay. He gets on his knees all right, but it's not to kiss the girls." And I'm just standing there like, okay, how many floors to go?
You know, so it really does explain who you are, really.
Yes.
But there's also something really interesting about your mom's past, which I wanted a little bit more explanation about, which is that she was born without a name or an address on her birth certificate. So what? And I know the sort of the history of her her parents, but I didn't really understand how no information could be on her birth certificate. Was she born in a hospital?
Yeah, she was born in a hospital in Washington, D.C. Her mother was a socialite in the Roaring Twenties in D.C., who I believe had an even worse, and I don't know this, but based on her behavior and the stories my mom told me, suffered from schizophrenia at an even deeper level than my mother did. So she was pretty violent. My mother was born and went straight into foster care along with her older brother, who was already in foster care. Mm-hmm. And there was no name on the birth certificate at all. A birth certificate was filed much later with a name that I had never known. I found it in her things after I finished writing the book. And so that set the tone for my mom. And when things would go wrong in her life, she would move to a different city and change her name. She was Ellen Marsden. Her last name was Perry Lawrence. She was Mary Matthews when she was married to my dad. There's names I don't even know. And so when she became Perry Lawrence, her last name, she was living in Palm Springs, actually. Mm-hmm. And she was in her 60s. She said, "You know, if you just bring a piece of mail with your name on it to the DMV, they will issue you an ID. I'm an old lady. They'll just let me do it. So please send me a postcard addressed to Perry Lawrence so I can see how it feels. And if I like it, I'll go and get a new driver's license." And she did.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's just unbelievable. You know, since you mentioned the schizophrenia, I want to go to that. Now, I've never talked about this, but my mother's mother, my mother was raised by a woman, her mother, who had mental issues. And this is, you know, we're talking about the 40s, the 50s. And that was a big stigma for a daughter because they whisper, "Oh, she's the one with that mother in the nut house." And she'd go in and then she'd come out and be fine until something would happen. And then she'd be back in. And my mother lived with that until, of course, much, much later, people found out that she was probably bipolar. And if they had had the medication and tools back then, could have actually had a normal life. But there was this stigma that you just locked people up is the point. And it's something that my mother has issues with depression. And I suspect that I probably do as well. Certainly, I'm not completely sane, but I look at that as a positive. So you talk about in the book that when your mom gets diagnosed much, much later in life and you find out that it is hereditary, that you start looking at the symptoms and you realize some of these I have, some of these I don't, some of these may be a choice, some of them may be traits. So where do you stand right now when it comes to mental illness and what you may have, if any?
Well, you know, as soon as she was diagnosed, there's so many misunderstandings about schizophrenia. I didn't really fully understand it. So she was in the ward for 2 weeks or so and when she was diagnosed. And I spent that time in my bathtub reading every schizophrenia book that I could possibly read. And I was very shocked to find out that it's not really one disease. There could be 70 different traits. It could be that you have visual hallucinations or you have audio hallucinations. Paranoia is pretty common among a lot of them, but there's just different things. And she was clearly affected by a lot of them. What she did in her life is she knew early on that there was something wrong with her. My dad had this conversation with me. He died a few years ago, but he said that she would always refuse to go to any psychiatrist. She would never seek help because he thinks that she knew what she did not want to risk being locked up. She did not want to be lobotomized. She did not want electroshock therapy. And that's what you suffered if you were admitted to mental health issues in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s. So,
well, at the point when you went to bring her in to be diagnosed, she fought you because she thought once she went in, she would never be coming out.
That's the most dramatic chapter in the book. And if anybody listening is an audiobook person, that whole thing happened during a thunderstorm. And so there's a low, in the audiobook, we produced it like an old time radio show where there's like
the storm.
Sounds throughout that chapter, and there's other fun, not fun, but there's other music that puts you in the mood and sounds throughout. So I've heard really good feedback from people who listen to the audiobook.
Do you read the book?
Especially about that chapter. What's that?
Do you read the audiobook?
I did the audiobook. Yeah. You did. I haven't listened to it because I read it, but I've listened to parts, and I'm a person who needs to read a book. I can't really listen to books, but there's a lot of people who are into audiobooks.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, if I'm going to do it, I want to do it as an arts project. When the publisher sent me three examples of the voices of actors or whatever who would read the audiobook, to me, it sounded like a pharmaceutical commercial. And I just thought,
you don't want that.
There's so many outlandish and funny things in the book. I just said, please let me do it myself. And my good friend Jackie, who has a little studio in a warehouse in Norfolk, she's in a lot of indie bands. She offered to do it as our lockdown arts project last spring.
Oh,
so
wow.
We would go there in the evenings. And she knows that you can go to freesounds.org and use these sounds that don't have any copyright. And there's this.
So the public domain effects, great.
Yes. And then there's this pop punk band called Broncho from Oklahoma that I'm friends with. And they actually were here in the house while writing their last album, and that album, when it came out, was very evocative of the feeling of the book. So I asked them if I could use five songs, because the book is in four parts. So it starts with music from Broncho, there's breaks with Broncho music, and then it concludes with one of their songs, Family Values. And they were happy to be a part of it. And so it was fun. It was fun doing like an old-time radio show, and I think
Now I want to listen to it. I'm going to have to go through it again. All right. But anyway, let's go back. So you found out all this stuff about schizophrenia, the scenes when you're in the tub reading all these different sort of takes. Oh, and I want to mention, because you also learned that schizophrenia, one of the theories is that it began in a geographic location on the west coast of Ireland.
Yep. Roscommon County. One of the books that I
which
read.
Which is also, where your mom's family is from, or part of them is from.
So my mom doesn't know who her father was. Her mother was of Irish descent. All she knows is that she's part Irish. And when I took her to Ireland on her 70th birthday, we drove through a bunch of villages. She didn't know where, but she heard that it was in a West County. So in reading this book, Stalking Irish Madness, about an Irish man whose family is schizophrenic, the epicenter of schizophrenia was documented to be in Roscommon County, Western Ireland. And I didn't know that at the time, but reading that book, it sort of made sense. Now, schizophrenia has genetic traits, but that doesn't mean it's going to be passed down to every generation. Now, I looked at some of the traits to figure out whether I might have some issues. And one of the traits is not being able to keep a steady job. I've been working at PETA since Ronald Reagan was president, or not being able to maintain friendships. And as I write in the book, I have more friends than an ecstasy dealer at Burning Man.
Also can laugh at inopportune moments, which I love because I do that.
Yes. One of the things is laughing at things where you're not supposed to laugh at. Like I do that in movies all the time. Like, Lady Bunny is one of my best friends, and we have been separated in movie theaters for laughing too loud at inappropriate times. Oh my God, you've got it!
Baby, you think I don't do my homework? Please, I adore you and Bunny. So yes, of course I do.
Well, Lady Bunny is in the book. She has visited this house twice. She came down for Thanksgiving. She and my mom were very close. In my first book called Committed, all about my life at PETA, There's an entire chapter with Lady Bunny and my mother set in Miami. But Bunny has, I put Bunny in that bathtub chapter where she says that she went to the psychiatrist. And I said, the psychiatrist said, Bunny, do you ever hear voices in your head? And I said, yes, doctor. And one of them just asked me if I ever hear voices in my head.
Again, so brilliant. Know,
reading all the books on schizophrenia, especially the heartbreaking memoirs, you know, these things don't usually end well. Because my mom was such a funny character with her intellectual wits about her, despite her suffering bouts of breakdowns from schizophrenia, I thought there needs to be a funny book in the mental health canon, and especially about schizophrenia, to show how it doesn't always end in drugs and violence, and as it's portrayed on TV and the crime shows.
Yeah.
Schizophrenics are actually less likely to be violent. Right. They are more likely to suffer from attacks on other people who don't understand their behavior or who get outraged at their weirdness or their paranoia, especially if they're in a relationship or even on the street. But I wanted to, in one of the last books that I read, one of the most recent schiz memoirs by a neurologist, he writes, and this book is only from less than 10 years ago. Uh-huh. He wrote that everything we know about schizophrenia is from documented reports of patients who were diagnosed usually in their teens or 20s and were treated in a facility and observed by some medical staff, by their family observations like this. What the natural progress of the disease in an untreated person who makes it into old age is unknown. And I just thought,
and yet,
oh my God, she wasn't just observed in a facility now and again. Bitch lived with me for 5 years. I know the ins and outs. I can talk about the details of how the breaks with reality came and how you learn to respond. I mean, when I would come down and she would be having conversations with people
that
weren't there.
And you would think she was on the phone, or you would think she was on the phone.
I literally thought she was on the phone. She was having a discussion about Russian cinema with my nephew, Grant. And Jack and I walked in, we were in the foyer here, and we heard her on the phone with Grant talking about Moscow Does Not Believe in Tears, Simone Signoret, her favorite Russian movie, and how, since we're of Russian descent, he should watch it. And it was not a monologue, it was a dialogue, and it was so lucid that we almost thought we could hear a slight buzz of Grant's response. And we got in closer, and then I looked and saw she's not on the phone. She's standing in the kitchen. She hasn't been able to talk on a phone in years. Her hearing is shot. She's almost deaf. And I thought, but it was such a peaceful conversation. It was so nice. And I thought, oh, this is what happens. This must be a part of like old person dementia.
Because she was convinced that she had talked on the phone. It wasn't even that you thought she talked to the phone. She would turn to you and say, I just spoke with Grant on the phone. And if you'd asked, how did you talk on the phone? That was the part that she couldn't explain. But vividly, she thought she did it.
The conversation was so pleasant that I didn't say, you're not on the phone. There's no phone.
What phone? Right.
Yeah. So I just thought, well, this is nice. And now she's got this house to go out of her head in, like old people do in one way or the other. But it got darker and darker and darker and darker. And she became quite hostile, as you can see in the book. Yeah. She would get very hostile with me, but she could never, ever get hostile with Jack.
Yeah, was great that you had somebody there that she trusted. But before it got hostile, I'm sorry of laughing. You know, there's so much to laugh about in this book. I don't want people to think that it is a downer. There's heavy things in there, but it is so funny, and it's presented first because I know you, so I know your style, but I also got to really know your mom. And I don't know if you're going to be able to tell me this off the top of your head, but do you remember the first time she admitted to hearing other voices?
Yes, she would. It really started with her saying that she heard herself singing off-key Christmas songs. And she hates Christmas songs, and she doesn't have a good voice. but she couldn't get her own voice singing Christmas songs out of her head. And then there was another one. It was an old slave hymn. Johnny Row the Boat Ashore?
No, was it Swing Low, Sweet Chariot?
Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Thank you.
I'm sorry to correct you on your own book.
Oh, no, no. There was various ones, but it was Swing Low, Sweet Chariot that she heard.
And she would sing it very lowly.
She would hear it in a big black baritone. Mm. Swing low, sweet. And I actually interpret her doing that in the audiobook. And she, when I brought her, she said that the problems must be with her hearing, not with her mind. So she agreed to go to an audiologist to see why she was hearing these things. And he did these different sounds with microphones on to test her hearing and all that. And that's when she discussed the different voices she heard and what they were, and did it mean she was going to die, or did it mean, what did it mean? And he said, I'm sorry, but I'm an audiologist, and I think you might have problems that stem more from the brain, and I can give you a referral if you'd like. And she said, Danny Lee, we're leaving, get my stuff, or we're out of here. And she got very hostile at the idea that she would have to go to see a psychologist, because it really wasn't an ear-related problem.
But she was also very clever. I loved, there's a point in the book where she talks about, you come in and she says to you, be careful of the kids on the stairs. And you look at her and she's like, hear the kids on the stairs. And you said to her, there are no kids on the stairs. And she thought for a second and whispered, Danny, it's the ghost of kids. And that was so funny and eerie and clever. It was so odd to me, because I'm like, I don't know what I would do in that moment, because it seems so earnest, but it's psychotic, but it's crazy, but it's funny.
It was so earnest and it was very peaceful. And this is the staircase. And at the base of the stairs, there was a little chair and side table that you used to use in the olden days when phones had to be on a table and they didn't have extension cords. We have a lot of weird old things in this house. Anyways, she was so sincere when she said it was the ghosts of children playing on the stairs that I walked her to bed and came back and sat at the base of the stairs and tried my hardest to open my mind. What if it is the ghosts of children playing on the stairs?
Because what if?
What if? I didn't see any ghosts. I wanted to. I used to live in a house.
You didn't hear any.
I didn't hear any. I'm not saying I don't believe in ghosts, because maybe some people have a better ability to see them than I do. But yeah. I in the whole process, I tried to keep my mind open to, you know, what she was going through, and not challenge her. And I think the biggest thing I learned from this experience, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that people often, especially with their parents, have to be right. There's no kids playing on the stairs. Go to bed. There's no phone. And all that does is ratchet up the tension. And when somebody's suffering from dementia or schizophrenia or any other bipolar, you need to dial things down. You mm-hmm. don't need to challenge them. You don't need to be right. You don't need for there to be a logical explanation.
Well, I think that is key, and I didn't get that in the book, but you're so right, because I know when I will have a discussion with anybody, and it doesn't have anything to do with psychology, but if you know something is a fact, and you are asserting this fact to somebody who believes in something else, by presenting it as a fact only elevates the tension. And I would think with somebody who isn't able to process things like we are, that's got to be exponentially worse.
Totally. There were, you know, like with the children on the stairs or the conversation.
What about when she heard other voices while watching Richard Simmons Sweating to the Oldies?
Now, this was an early sign. So she was, you know, she was largely deaf. And right after I moved her in, she would blare the TV downstairs full tilt playing Richard Simmons Sweating to the Oldies. And it's not because she was exercising. It's because Richard Simmons' voice distracted her from the other voices in her head. I didn't know that at the time. It's just that she was blasting the stuff that I would hear it upstairs when I was trying to go to sleep. And I would have to come turn things down or tell her. And she wasn't often even in the same, she would be in the bedroom, but Richard Simmons was blaring in the living room. And only after her diagnosis and only after she got treated, you know, minimal dose of Risperdal Constant made the voices not disappear, but fade to such an extent that she was able to have peaceful thoughts of her own without distractions. And that was for the last several months of her life. And after that, all these other things that she was doing the first, you know, 4 years of us living together here started to make sense. And so, you know, I've since I've written this book, I have had such wonderful, tender emails from people. I just got one from a woman who said that she wishes she had had this book a year ago, because right. in February of this year, her father died. Schizophrenic, but was never treated and never, nobody knew how to deal with it. And if she had had this book as a kind of guidepost, that it would have made her life a lot easier. Another woman in North Carolina said that she saw the book at Barnes & Noble, and she got it because her own mother was schizophrenic. Her kids are not, but she had no way to explain to them the mania that she was living with and going through. But when she got my book, she got a copy for her daughter so her daughter could understand what her life was like and what her mother's life was like. And just yesterday, I got a sweet message on Instagram from a woman who's very involved in mental health in California and speaks on the topic and who has a schizophrenic son. And she says this book has made it all so not only easy to understand, but funny, and to show that it's not that everything, you know, you just think how tragic and how awful this is going to be, your outlook and the upbeat attitude and the determination to not let it end in misery is what so many people need to bolster themselves to go through, and to have to laugh when you need to laugh when you're not supposed to laugh. I will say that one of my mother on my on her deathbed, we had a hospice care nurse here during my mom's last week. And she was gone for the weekend, and the hospice care nurse said to me in front of my mom, "Do you know what to do when the time comes?" And my mom said, "Well, I know what to do. Danny says that since they haul away the trash on our street on a Thursdays, that I should wait until Thursday to pass so they can lug me away with the rest of the garbage." And the hospice nurse was like, "These are not usually funny moments," but we all just sat there and laughed.
You know, she had, you know, what I love about the book, and again, mentioning it again, like crazy, there it is, is that you really do get a sense, because I think a lot of people who know somebody, and, you know, I will use the blanket phrase like crazy, which of course is the book, because you don't know what kind of crazy or depression or whatever somebody has. But you kind, you know, when somebody has a mental illness, you see them as that crazy person, and you forget that they have other traits. And what I loved about this book is that your mother is so funny through the whole book. She's really smart. She travels with books, like boxes and boxes of books. She is intelligent. She loves going to museums. She had, you know, it's funny, like we started this conversation about, are you happy? What makes you happy? I have friends who, when I say, "Well, what did you do today that made you happy?" they can't come up with things. And yet your mother, even in the throes of schizophrenia, was finding a quality of life that so many people don't have. And I did write a quote that before she'd go out, she would say to you, "I may be a pathetic old lady, but I refuse to look like one." And that was because she didn't want the cane. She didn't want to hold the cane. And she maintained her identity, which I think is so valuable for all people, whoever they are, that they be seen as a person. They're not gay or old or crazy. They're still a person. And she knew who she was. She didn't lose that even till the end. And I think that's beautiful that you gave her the grace to be who she was.
Well, it was my duty and it was my honor. And wow. I didn't have any idea when I was getting into this. No, and this was a really difficult book to write. I had to read so many scientific books. I wanted to, you know, get it just right, but then regurgitate it in a way that was funny and plain spoken at the same time so that people could relate. I will say, you know, you're talking about how she would find the humor and even the smallest things. She imparted that on me when I was a kid.
Really?
When I first moved her in here, she would always watch the subtitles had to be on when we watched TV because she couldn't hear it. And
my parents are doing that now. So, yeah, I know.
Well, when you are, for me, when the subtitles are on, you can't not look at them. You just, you know, and you kind of, you're not really watching the show anymore. But they get it wrong sometimes. And we were watching Hillary Clinton give a speech. And in the speech, she said the words, "the greatest nation." And the subtitle said, "the great estrogen." And my mom and I would make a habit of like, they're calling. And then there was another, we were watching some gladiator movie on TCM. And a woman told the love interest, "you are romantic." And the subtitle said, "you are Roman dick." It happens, I wouldn't say frequently, but a lot. Enough that we started watching them just for the mistakes that they would make. And maybe it's a transcriber that is transcribing the things. And it
or
all, sometimes
speech
they just
to
don't.
Text, who knows?
Yes, yes. But so we would find ourselves watching something and having no idea what was happening because all we were doing was looking for mistakes in the subtitles.
But see, that's the thing, is that you find something that makes you happy in anything. The other thing I loved, and you do this from the very beginning of the book, I don't know if it was a conscious decision on your part or if it's who you are. You never refer to the house as my house. Even though you bought it, you came up with the plan, you took your mother in, but you present it constantly as our house. When she comes, you said, my friend Diego brought her to our house. And I thought to myself, for anybody, particularly the older people or sick people, to give them the dignity to feel that this is their home, they're not imposing on you. Was that something that you did purposefully, or is it just who you
are? Oh, very purposely, because when we were kids, she was often without she worked for temp agencies. She couldn't work at any place for any period of time, and was, you know, her and my dad split when I was like six. And she raised mostly me and my two brothers on her own. And we often had the phone cut off. We were evicted. We were evicted once we didn't have a car and we had to move in shopping carts. This is all in my first book, Committed. And rereading Committed now and talking about those childhood times when I first learned to protect animals through her, you know, instruction. But just looking at our life then, it's clear to me now that she was suffering from schizophrenia in that book,
sure.
Even though I didn't know it. But she, because we were evicted, moved in shopping carts, had the lights cut off, often didn't have a phone, getting this house, for her to have a house that was not just mine, but hers to have her last act in, was the whole purpose of it. It was not for, you know, it was not an investment for me, or I've always lived in studio apartments or one bedroom apartments because I gallivant around the world. I just, you know, with all of my animal activism and PETA work, I just never needed more than a tiny home base. So it was very on purpose to bring her in to our house. I had never had a house. She had never had a house. And so this was it. And then when Jack came into the picture and then it was his house too. And now is, you know, it was a wonderful time because she loved Jack so much. And for her last 4 years, his involvement and especially in not only fixing things, but interacting between me and her when she would go off the deep end.
Well, as you said, she trusted him. She was always nice to him, even if she was combative with you.
Right. And she loved being a part of my life with the PETA work and looking things up online. She would she would know I was arrested at a protest before I was even released from jail. She would have Google.
She's also very proud of you. What I love is that even when you would sit there and say, oh, my God, I'm going to go home and I'm going to hear you, she would say, good for you. And she was so supportive, which, again, with what you do, because in before our last president made this a bad word, an agitator, a provocateur, that's really who you are. And it's right. Not just for the sake of provoking, it is for a cause. But nonetheless, you have a method and you have a style, and that could rub somebody the wrong way. But she seemed to relish in it.
She did. And, you know, one really, really important point to make, and it's made in the book, is that in a sense, I owe my life's work of defending animal rights to her, because and in part to her mania, to her schizophrenia, because she may have had an impossible time maintaining long-term relationships with humans, but she always bonded with animals, always. And there was a connection there. She could see the hurt in an abandoned animal on the street that she felt in herself as somebody who was often homeless. Even as a youngest, as like when I was 5 and 6 years old, we were bringing in cats from the streets that kids were throwing baseballs at her, throwing them against the stucco wall behind the garage. You know, kids can be cruel.
And older animals that had been left behind, or bringing it to people, your friends who were gay, who had been thrown up by their families. And I did make a note of that, is that your mother became a surrogate mom to strays of all kinds. She was really had this heart, and also maybe because of the mental illness and her own experiences, had enormous empathy for underdogs, which is a great thing.
You hit it perfectly. She had such empathy, no matter how rotten our situation was financially or whatever as kids, there was always somebody worse off. You turn on the news and she would go march for immigrants' rights. She would go to drive up to Malibu to help millionaires dig out during mudslides. There was always somebody that needed a hand, and she was always there. Whether it was especially for personal friends who were rejected by their own parents, or if there was a cause of the day. And when she came to visit me when I was I graduated from American University with a history degree in D.C. Mm-hmm. And when she came to visit me, it wasn't for Parents' Day. It was for the anniversary of the March on Washington in 1963. This was like in 1983. And she was tear gassed marching against the Ku Klux Klan.
Wow. And
that's when she came to visit me to make it coincide with this anti-racism march to commemorate Martin Luther King's march. And I just thought, and my friends who met her in college, she was like, meet me at Farragut North train station. I've tear gassed and I need to wash out my eyes, but I can still make it for lunch.
And that brings up another aspect of your book, which I found particularly interesting, because there's a lot of history in the book, particularly Civil War history, because of where you're living. And it was you give a lot of color and background about stuff that I did not know about, and that that your mom was really fascinated in, that she loved museums and statues and gardens with historical significance and antiques that made, anything that had a story. And I thought to myself that somebody, it's interesting that when we look through history and we look at people who were great artists that might have been tortured or offbeat in some way, they might have just been seeing an aspect of something that other people didn't, that just passed people by, but their intellect allowed them to see. And it made me wonder, how smart was your mother? Did she ever have her IQ taken? Because it seems to me that a lot of people who we say are crazy are actually geniuses.
She was a genius. She was brilliant. Yeah. I don't know what her IQ level was, but she was a genius in a lot of different ways. She was compassionate in every way you can imagine.
Had a great memory. She knew dates and things.
Yes, yes. And she would remind me, the anniversary of your dad and stepmom is next Tuesday. Make sure you send a card. things like that. She was absolutely brilliant. And I think, and it's another reason why I wanted to write the book, because there are highly functioning schizophrenics. And I would say that toward the end, she was non-functional. I think that's what I somehow, as her son, knew inside that that was coming. Mm-hmm. And I, in a fit of desperation, got the house in the wake of having written my first book. I was able to put a down payment on this place. It's an 1870 Victorian filled with weird thrift shop stuff. And it ended up working out in a very poetic destiny sort of, we were destined to do this. And my plan was to sell the house the minute she dropped and move back into the apartment.
I had that here, that you said in the book that really this was something to make her comfortable, but was not part of your long-term plan at all.
Exactly. But then when the market crashed and the recession hit and it was instantly worth, you know, almost half of what I paid for it, a third less, and was not rebounding, still hasn't really rebound.
You had a great neighbor that helped you, though, that told you things you could do.
Yeah, the guy who owns the Commodore Theater, it's the old mm-hmm. Deco movie theater, he lives on the other side of the fence from us. And he is a master electrician, and he loved my mom. An ex-con bartender friend of mine came over after the last call one night, saw my mom's crappy computer, and said, I think you need a new laptop, and gives her the laptop from a friend of his who's still doing time. Like, it's very, like...
And she was worried that it might be hot.
Yes.
Which I loved. And they gave it to her on Thanksgiving or Easter?
Easter. It was Easter. Yeah, we drove down to North Carolina, which is about 45 minutes away from here. She was like, Danny, I'm so excited to have this computer, but let's not stop for coffee on the North Carolina side. Wait until we get to Virginia in case it's hot. You had this imagination that the cops
again,
might
this
be
is such, you know, this, you know, again, to somebody like me who loves eccentric people, I can see the humor in it, but I've also cared for people who have gone through dementia, and I know the struggle. And it is, you know, I don't want to minimize what you did, because it's exhausting. It's physically and mentally exhausting, because you almost can never sleep because something could happen. And I wonder if when she finally did pass, was it a weight off of you as well, because you would resolve so many of her issues that she could pass peacefully?
It was a celebration that she made it this far and was able to, and that not only was she able to, but that I was able to, and my brothers and everyone who knew her were able to figure out what was wrong all this time, all these decades. What was it that set her, that would make her move to a different city and change her name, that, you know, all these things were explained with the diagnosis, which happened in the last year of her life.
Right.
And as tragic as that was, and the whole scene of having to have her committed for 2 weeks, it did. That was when the weight really lifted off. But then she did, dying right before Christmas. And I will not give away the ending.
I don't want to do it either. Because it's funny and poignant and a little icky, but a little bit kooky. So it's
I just did a Maya Bialik's podcast, and she said, you know, as much as I want to talk about the grand finale, we can't talk about it because, and I told her that the original version of the book that I turned in, that was the opening scene, and then it went into flashback.
Oh, you can't do that.
And Simon and Schuster said, the only edits we have is the opening has to be the ending, because there's nowhere to go after that.
Right.
It's so dramatic.
I really thought to myself that there's a part of me that was kind of angry when she was finally diagnosed, because there's that part of me that wonders, and again, the what if, I'm a what if kind of person, that had she been diagnosed 10 years, 20 years earlier, A, she would have had a longer, good quality of life, but also it seems that her mental capacity diminished her physical capacity as well.
Yes, it's a really important point that you bring up, because the drugs that she responded to a minimal amount of, Risperdal Consta, it's called, they only had people historically have not taken their meds for mental health issues because it made them sluggish. It made them add loads of weight. It just basically
comatose.
Yeah, made them comatose.
Yeah.
And my mom was so bright and so vivid and so energetic and so vital that she would never, ever have taken the meds. Even the meds about 5 or 10 years before she was diagnosed were fine-tuned to not be so deadening. And so as a result, she was able to get a shot every 2 weeks, and it would last for another 2 weeks, toward the end of which she would get a bit out there. And Jack and I would put a dissolvable kind of tablet in her vegan ice cream at night that she loves so much, dreamy tofutti.
Yes.
And
the reason she had to have the shot was because even though this helped her to maintain a normal life, she was still not going to take it.
She was still determined not to take it. But then even though the nurse who came to give it was a really hot guy, a nurse who she liked a lot like that, which did help. Mm-hmm. But no, she did fight it. And I had to say, if we're going to be able to continue living in our house like this, you have to take it. If you refuse, we have to figure out other plans, but to move forward. And then she would agree. And it was a very, very rational conversation. It never devolved into screaming. I did that at first. I sunk to having the screaming matches about the mania before I knew what was going on, because I would come home from work and there'd be candles all over the place. And she would say that this person died, that person died. Yes. And it was like, and then Jack, having had 4 kids, much more patient than I, intervened and, you know, helped me chill out as well. It's a really nice domestic story that has a kind of shocking happy ending that I didn't see coming when it was happening.
Well, it certainly is a peaceful resolution, which, again, I know so many people who've gone through things like this, and 90% of them don't end as, you know, tied up almost in a little bow like yours did. But talking about the medication, you did something which, first off, I love that you did it, and yet I was afraid for you. Your mother was on lots of pills. And I know this because a friend of mine whose mom went through dementia, when you're somebody like in pain, in either physical pain, mental pain, whatever, you are desperate to find something that works. And when you find things that work, you just kind of integrate them into other things. So you're taking pills from all sorts of sources. You don't know the interaction. You don't know what's helping, what's hurting, what's cutting each other off. So you had a doctor friend, Doc Holliday.
Doc Holliday, he's gorgeous.
Oh,
and so sweet. So just.
Is he single? Please? One
no,
of you? Anybody
no, he's
in
not
this?
Anymore.
God, Jesus. All right, forget it. But anyway, so you decided with Doc Holliday to find out what all of these pills did.
Yes. So
go
Doc
ahead,
Holliday, he's one of my best friends, and I've somebody that I've known for 20 years before my mom moved here. And he helped instantly from the day she arrived to try to help figure out how she was doing, you know, in addition to her normal doctor visits. It really helps when you've got a patient. I don't want to say the word blessed. I was lucky to have a best friend who also happened to be an ER physician who could recognize lots of different things. He said that he thinks the root of her problems with hearing the voices and being fragile and falling down and all that was that she was on so many different opiates. This was before the opioid crisis. This was in the lead up to it, when doctors would just prescribe. And my mom, with her different names and different doctors in different cities, collected meds, thinking that there was going to be some new magic pill that would make all the, she was also arthritic, that make the voices and the, you know, arthritis pain disappear.
Sure.
So Doc came over, Doc Holliday. His name is Jeff Holliday, but since he's a doctor, of course, we all call him Doc Holliday.
Of course. Why wouldn't we?
He said she's on too many pills. She's got to pick one painkiller and stick with it. And so he told her that. And my best friend, David Cohen, who was also really close with my mom, he's a landscaper, gardener in D.C.
Oh, right. He came
down and my mom said, I don't know which one to pick. You guys have back pain. I've had, you know, lifelong back pain. David had arthritis from the gardening work. She said, you guys, will you take each one, sample the pills and tell me which one's the keeper? I can't tell one from the other anymore. I have no idea. So David came down for a long weekend of painkillers. And we took notes on each of them. We figured out which ones, but there was one that we couldn't even follow the plot on Green Acres. It made us so like, that one goes in the trash. There was another one, Vicodin, if you took a half, it could be okay. But we figured out which one should be tossed and which one she should keep. And we tossed all the ones that were just too deadening. And it was an interesting little study. You know, as Mayim said, she wouldn't recommend this to people at home.
No, she would not.
We did have doctor supervision. And as my mom said, you guys are sturdy, you know, healthy, younger adults. If I'm a little old lady, it's not going to, you know, you're just going to help me field the assortment to figure out what's best. And it did help. It did help. I actually, as you know, at the end of that chapter thought, we have done it. We have solved the problem. She's off these four rotten opioids that were making her go out of her mind. And I really thought that was going to be the magic ticket. That's a fun chapter. That is.
But again, what leads up to that chapter, which was scary, was that really she had two major falls within days of arriving at your house. And so it wasn't. At that point, you're thinking to yourself that it's just a physical issue or a medication issue.
Balance issue.
And you know, an old lady issue. Oh, what are you going to do? And she, again, even when she falls, although when she falls on her face, that's the worst. But she has such wherewithal about her that the first fall, she's like, oh, I'm okay. And the second one, you better call 911.
Well, the first one from the parking lot, it was at a Mexican restaurant not far from where Doc Holliday works. And so he was on, luckily, and we dealt with that. The second one, we were up in Richmond. It was during Christmas time, and it was a terrible fall. And she was just even in a situation where she had fallen face first into an elevator railing, and I had to bring her to the ER, and it was gruesome. It was one of the most mortifying moments of my life. And
before you say the punchline, but I also want to say you point out that you found out from hospital people that when elder people are brought in with things like this,
especially at the holidays,
that they immediately suspect elder abuse, which never would have even occurred to me.
Yeah. So I didn't know that until we get to the ER, and my mom loved to document everything. She went everywhere with her camera, and she was like this before cell phone cameras. She was like this with her Instamatic. She liked to capture every moment. We're in the ER. The curtain is pulled around you, and her face looks like a meat lover's pizza. There's like blood, and it was so awful. She reaching into her bag, pulls out her camera, and says, Danny, you've got to take a picture. I'll never look like this again. And I was like, what? So, okay. So I'm taking pictures and she's posing like a Southern Belle, but with blood everywhere. And that's when the doctor and nurse pull the curtain over and say, what are you doing? And I was like, she asked me to document the moment. And they're like, you go wait over there. We're going to ask her how this happened. And it was... there's just so many funny scenes like that in the book where it is something that is gut-wrenching, but because of her reaction and because of our dynamic, it became like a scene from a Fellini movie or just,
Which is ironic because her favorite actress was?
Giulietta Messina.
Yes, exactly.
Fellini's.
Fellini's
ex-wife protege and muse, yes.
Or muse, yes. Okay, so I do want to show people a picture of your mom in an earlier years, but that
what
is not
I do
the
with
picture.
That shirt?
Yeah, well, that seems to be the topic of conversation on Facebook. People want to find out where that shirt is, but is the other picture here? All right? I believe you have a fondness for Halloween.
Oh yes, I was born right before Halloween.
On Halloween Eve.
Yes. Well, I was born October 25th at Hoag Hospital in Newport Beach, Costa Mesa. But it was a Saturday, and it was a Saturday before Halloween. And my mom and dad loved telling me how she went into labor, and the doctor had to be called, found, and he was at a Halloween party dressed as Dracula. So I was delivered by Dracula. And that's after midnight on, the Saturday night before Halloween. And I swear that just, I was a large baby, so there was blood everywhere. And I think, as I write in the book, I've always, because I was born right around Halloween, I always had Halloween-themed birthday parties. And my mom loved it too, being a drama queen and all that stuff. So, and I moved into this house on October 31st. That's when the closing deal came. And my ex, Damien, who helped me move into the house, we were sitting on the steps, and there was a few trick-or-treaters walking by. But this is an incredible gothic block. Incredible. And I thought, you know what? We need to turn up the volume on Halloween next year. And a friend of mine who's in the Navy, who brought over this giant gargoyle, smoke machines everywhere, my friends hiding in the bushes to scare the trick-or-treaters. The kids started coming around and around to come back on our block.
Of
And within a few
course.
years, Halloween became a huge open party, a huge open house. And it's still it, now it's 12 years later, and it's still like that. And my mom used
And
to
your
get these
mom
runs.
loved it.
Yes, and her last Halloween, it was shortly after Amy Winehouse's death. She went as Amy Winehouse, complete with Coke residue and a bottle of bourbon. Yes, there
There
she
she
is.
is. I adore that picture. And again, it's first off, if I were going to give a criticism to the book, and I know you can't do it, I want more pictures. I want far more pictures because afterwards, I couldn't wait to go look. The good thing is we have internet. The world is our picture gallery.
Well, as with the first book, my first book Committed, I thought I want there to only be one photo per chapter in black and white at the opening so that your imagination can do a lot more than pictures. If it becomes a photo book, then it's not so much a work of literature, but it's a photo book. And
Right, and they have committed.
as tempting as it was, oh, thank you for putting that up.
Of
And this
course.
one's more focused on my lifetime
PETA
work for
work.
animal rights and how I went from a gay bash teen into animal rights activist and the early days of PETA and all the campaigns we did to put the movement on the map around the world. And my mom was everybody's favorite character in that book. And so when it came time to write a follow-up, it was clear that it had to be about her. And then I moved her in. I had no idea where it was going with the skits or anything like that, but it feels like it was destined now.
Well, did you want, so now I have some general questions. Did you want to write a book? Did you want to write a book about your mother? What was the impetus for this? Was there going to be a book anyway about something?
Yes,
Because you've
I
always
started.
been, I should tell people that you were always a freelance writer. You had always done a lot of articles, and you're really very funny, obviously. You know that I know that.
You're very kind.
We've traveled in the same circles. You had a column in Genre for years. So, I mean, and then TV Guide, you did a lot of stuff. So I know. But I
Yeah,
want
even
people to
I mean,
know
my
you're a writer.
well, my first published thing was in a punk zine back in 1981 about animal experiments. It was a very dark poem in this little punk scene that was run by X-Zine, the singer of X. So even when I was still in high school and in the old punk scene, writing was always my thing. And so I did it freelance, always, as a thing I always did. I interviewed Morrissey when he came over for the Smiths Meet His Murder tour. That was right before I started at PETA. That's when I was 20. I would interview artists and ask questions about issue-oriented things that I thought would be interesting to share with their fans. I interviewed Nina Hagen for LA Weekly back in the 85, and it just trans you know I it just I've always written. And so my mom, the whole point when I first moved her in, the point of the book was to portray a senior that you people dismiss seniors as never having been whores, as never having been hilarious, as never having lived a life of a young person. They just put them in this geriatric box. And because my mom was so brash and hilarious, I thought that there might be a book in just our life here, moving into this house without either of us knowing what to do. It's our first house. both of us.
Did you keep notes?
Oh, yes. I mean, the thing I always did in writing was I never would, have a set time to go write. When something happened that I knew was going to be a scene in the book or a book or something, I write it down instantly, like that night, whether it's on cocktail napkins or on, notepads, I would vividly relay the scene onto a page so that I didn't forget the details. And Simon & Schuster, my publisher, said that's why they, I think agreed to do the second book is because it is so full of vivid details that it brings the whole story to life. And I've been writing I'm 56 now. I guess I've been writing for 30 years, and I try to improve with each a book or article and make it more amusing and make it more, because life is tough. And I've always dealt with serious topics, whether it's animal rights or now schizophrenia. And I think when you're dealing with a rough topic, it's even more important to be funny. It's even more important to laugh at the dark side of things, because otherwise you suffocate from the
heaviness
of
it. Yeah. I have so many photos of you here. I mean, I have photos of you on my computer, just generally speaking, but for the show. And there was somebody who was very close to me who was a huge influence on my life, and I was glad to know, and you also know, and that was Joan Rivers, whose birthday was 2 days ago. So let's talk about your relationship with Joan.
Well, that is Jack, and that's Joan, me. That was at one of her very last shows on Long Island just a few months before she died. And Joan and I have a pretty wild history, because she was a big fur wearer. And
I
first started at PETA in the 80s, and she had her talk show, it was she had me on to debate the Fur Council on her talk show. And I think I was 23 at the time. And it was the time when it was all in the news about people spray painting fur coats and things like that. And so we started the debate. We were on a set. And she said to me, now, what would you do if I didn't like what you were wearing, Dan, and decided to spray paint all over it? And I just replied that I would be the proud owner of a Joan Rivers designer original. And she laughed her ass off and said, oh, okay, well, I don't support this thing, but let's keep in touch. So and I like dogs and cats. Maybe I can help PETA on dog and cat issues, which she did. She helped us on, sheltering issues, on adoption issues. And Joan, even though she was so reviled by animal activists for wearing fur it didn't stop her from calling me once in a while when she heard about some animal bill and how could she help. And I just thought, we live in such bitter, partisan, separatist times that my ongoing relationship with her off and on since the 80s, I think is a testament and a great example of how people should be now. And it's an example that I give repeatedly in like crazy, because our neighbor is a Republican who wears a gun on his belt. And he is the first person to have helped my mom and to have helped us with the house, even though he knows that we are hardcore liberal atheist and all that stuff. It doesn't matter. Here in Old Town, we're all in this little village, and it's of every black, white, gay, straight, trans, people from tinier towns than this who think it's a big town. And it's just, the book shows an example of what I think America not only could be like, but what America is in some places and how people can really get along.
It certainly has been in the past.
And not let their differences drive them apart. And so Joan was really, really great about that. And what's interesting is when Jack and I went backstage to hang with her after her show, it was just the three of us at first before everybody else came back. We had a really great hang. She said, this is before Jack and I had ever discussed the marriage issue, and it had just become legal in New York or Massachusetts or something. She said, all right, he's a catch. Are you two married? And I said, oh, no, we're not into that sort of thing. She said, take it from me, get married. You're getting married. Let me know when you're getting married. That's all there is to it. You're getting married. And so that, we just kind of laughed it off at the time. And it was, earlier in our relationship. But that was the first time the notion was introduced by Joan fucking Rivers. So it was kind of interesting. And then we followed her advice. She was really, really hilarious. You know, that meeting, by the way, that last meeting, a few months before she died, the point of the meeting for me is, you know, she was really reviled for continuing with the fur. And I said, Joan, you know, your legacy is about a lot of things, but it should not be about you just being a heartless fur wearer in this era where we know about how animals are electrocuted and drowned. And she said, I know, it's awful. It's awful. It's awful. I said, well, wouldn't it be interesting as a postscript if you left your fur coats in your will to PETA to paint and use in protests and to, you know, paint them after her death the way we wanted to in real life. And she said, that's perfect. If you will write it up, I will share it with my lawyers. And that is going to, that's the perfect way to go so that the issue is put to bed, because I am a bitter bitch and I don't want to like give up on my, you know, stance about it. So I wrote it up. I sent it to her and her assistant. And a few weeks later, she loved it. She shared it with her lawyers. She changed a few words and I followed up. And I talked to her assistant and she said, we're getting to it. We're getting to it. She's got some medical appointments next week and then we'll get to it. And
yeah,
she died the next week before I could be formally adapted into her will. But she I was invited to her funeral. And so I, you know, dropped everything, of course, and flew to New York. Where the funeral is at the synagogue on the Upper East Side with, you know, Howard Stern, Donald Trump was there. Everybody, it was a really emotional moment for me, because our, I wouldn't say bitter, but our tug of war relationship about these issues that went on for 25 years or
decades.
So, decades, we remain friends, and we remain friends to the end. And it breaks my heart that, you know, if it had been just a week or two more, it would have probably been formalized in her will and would have been a wonderful publicity thing.
Melissa's watching. Melissa, Missy, send him the damn coats.
Another one of our, with PETA too, so.
I know, I love Missy, but well, I can't call her Missy. She won't love me if I say that. But we have another very close friend in common, which was the last place where we saw each other. The Go-Go's, but particularly Belinda Carlisle. And memorably, during their very first reunion, they posed for this photo, which became a huge poster, which is in my bathroom, I might add. We'd rather go-go naked than wear first. So how did, I'm thinking that the Go-Go's came into your life during your punk days. I may be wrong.
Yes. In 1979, when I was at Costa Mesa High and punk was brand new in Orange County and had only just really gotten off the ground in LA in 77 and 78. Of course it's kind of started in England in 75, but I was, I think 14 years old. And the first punk rocker in my high school, Connie Pearson, we became really good friends. And she said, there's this all girl punk band coming down to play the Cuckoo's Nest, on Friday night. You really shouldn't miss them. And I went, and it was the Go-Go's, and it was in a club that probably held 150 people. And they were still chubby punk chicks with spiky hair. And I guess I met Charlotte and Margot first. Mm-hmm. Margot later left the band. And there wasn't really a backstage. There was like a pool room with a pool table in it and like a grungy bathroom that was spray painted. And that's how I first met them. I was still in high school. And
wow.
it was before they had even released an album. It was 2 years before Beauty and the Beat came out. All of a sudden they became really huge. And so when I started working at PETA in 1985, I knew that Jane Wedlin had been publicly really sympathetic to animal rights. So I reached out to her, and Jane got very involved as one of PETA's first celebrity supporters. And then Belinda, right on the heels of that, in the 80s, when she was a solo artist, was doing PETA campaigns. And when they announced their first reunion tour back in 89, I suggested this poster that they could sell at their merch table that would benefit PETA. And not only to benefit PETA, like, you know, financially, but that we could share the image with the press in every town where the 25 city tour was going. And you better believe that the New York Post put it on the front of the entertainment section. And you better believe that in everywhere they went. And, you know, it was on Entertainment Tonight. It was it was the launch of our Rather Go Naked Than We're First celebrity campaign. They were before Christy Turlington, before Kim Basinger, before Pamela Anderson. It was the Go-Go's. And that poster came out in 1990. And the campaign ran until last year. I formally ended it in 2020, because by that time, most of the designers had dropped fur. Of course, we had infiltrated their runways. We'd done so many investigations on fur farms, exposing all the cruelty. But the thing that kept it in the public eye every year was the Rather Go Naked Than Wear Fur campaign with all these different celebrities. Pink did it. Gillian Anderson was one of the last to do it. And I thought, It's been an even 3 decades. Fur is dead. The campaign has succeeded. Let's call it a day. And it was the Go-Go's.
But it started, but before the Go-Go's, there was you.
But it started in the streets. Yes, that was me and my friend
Japan.
Julie. Yes, the Go-Go's were the first celebrities to do it as an advertisement. But the campaign actually started, in the streets. There was a fur convention in Tokyo. And I was running the PETA Fur campaign, and I tried to convince the Japanese groups to do some sort of protest. And they said protest is frowned upon in Japan. It's considered rude. The public will side with the fur trade. We will just pass out leaflets and say a Buddhist prayer and hope for the best. And
thanks.
I was like, God, if Japanese economy is booming, if fur takes off there, we'll be really in trouble. So I thought, what can we do? And that was my friend Julia, who I just caught up with last week, by the way, in San Francisco.
Yeah.
She quit her job. She's somebody I went to college with. She quit her job as a receptionist wherever she was working at the time and flew to Tokyo with me. And on the way there, we figured out what we had to figure out what to do as just two people in one of the biggest media markets of the world, Tokyo, to focus attention on this issue. And I thought, what if we pretend we're an American stripper couple who flew to Tokyo to do our act outside of the fur fair? But with a banner that says we'd rather go naked than wear fur. And our plan was to we got really dressed up. I was wearing a suit. She was wearing this beautiful dress because there wasn't much to do other than take off our clothes. So we better have a lot of clothes to take off if we're strippers. Anyone who's been to a strip show, you know, it's all about the teeth. So we did that. We were hoping there would just be one photographer or one TV station, or we had no idea. These troubled teens from the Japanese animal group loved it and helped us on the sly since the animal groups officially didn't want to participate or even help us. So we did it. We took the subway to the fur fair. We got out of the subway station and there were dozens and dozens of reporters. We actually thought Madonna might be in town or there was a presidential news conference, but they were there for the naked protesters. And we took off all of our clothes and there was so many cameras, CNN, Fuji TV, they were circling around us. And I said, Julia, we can't just stand here and pose. We have to turn this into a march. And so we marched nude through this one was actually in Hong Kong. The first one was in Tokyo. It became such a sensation that Ingrid Newkirk, the founder of PETA, said, this is in USA Today. This made it all over the news, all over the world. You guys cannot come home. Go to the next fur fair in Hong Kong. There's another one in Madrid.
Or Madrid. There's Madrid. I know. Tian, I'm ready for you.
So Julie and I, who knew that? I mean, I started at PETA as the receptionist, and just because I had crackpot
ideas. Is that how you started?
Yeah. When I was 20
years old. You were the receptionist?
Yeah. But I always had these ideas of things to do. And so I was promoted within my first year to the campaigns department. There was only 10 of us when I was hired, working out of a rented house. We didn't even have an office. So, yeah, that was 36 years ago. Oy.
You know, I'm curious about the PETA. idea. You know, I saw a documentary about a month, maybe 2 months ago, and it was this documentary about plants. And it was about how plants feel. And plants, you know, we think of plants as, oh, there's a flower and we pluck it. And it's like, oh, they feel, they hurt, they cry, whatever. And I thought to myself, you know, there was a time when we kind of looked at animals the way we look at plants today. Is that, oh, isn't that pretty? Isn't that rabbit pretty? And you kill it and you got a muff. And you say, isn't that a nice flower? And you cut it and you put it in a vase. And I thought to myself, if we get to a point, say 20, 30 years from now, that we look at plants the way a lot of people look at animals, that we can't use them for ourselves because we have to think of their feelings, then I wonder where that ends. Is there
a very little shot of horrors?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm wondering. Right, exactly. So, I mean, is there an idea that plants could at some point have rights too, and that we shouldn't be eating plants and raping the soil for our sustenance?
Well, I'm a big believer in science, and I believe in the scientific divisions of animal, vegetable, and mineral, the three building blocks of the world. And I believe that all animals have much more in common than we have differences. We have beating hearts. We have, I mean, octopus are the most brilliant creature, biggest brains on, you know, most clever creatures on the planet. To me, it's if something is going to struggle to get away from you because they want to live and you want to kill them, whether to eat them or to wear them, whether it's a lamb or a cow or a fox or a rabbit and a or a rat in a laboratory, we have no right. We have no right to do that. They have rights to live. I believe that plants are a totally different, you know, phylum, obviously. I believe that obviously our environmental degradation of plants and the environment is a wake-up call. We've seen that. We can't bulldoze the rainforest and expect the climate not to get overturned as a result. So I think we have to be mindful of the place plants and plants play in our environment and how they need to be nurtured and not ravaged. But I'm not really, I'm not among those who think that we shouldn't pluck flowers. I know that, you know, vase plants, vase things are awesome. If we get to that point and there's scientific information that says we should just have, then I'm open to it. But I do believe now in the three scientific phylums of animal, vegetable, and mineral. And
I'm curious. Because the one thing we know about as time goes on is our consciousness grows, our knowledge grows, and, you know, the way we make decisions is based on what we know at that time. We can't make decisions based on what they knew 100 years ago. And I am not a vegetarian, but I also am for the humane use of animals. And when I've seen videos that PETA has exposed of the way animals can be tortured or really raised in such captivity that they go crazy or that they're pumped full of chemicals, I mean, the things that you have done have really opened my eyes to then say, yeah, that's really yummy, but maybe there's something yummy that doesn't make me feel quite as icky.
It's easy now. I mean, in 1985, when I first started at PETA, the whole idea of vegetarian was some like hippie thing from this little niche thing from the 70s. People didn't even use the word vegan back then in the 80s. They thought a vegan was somebody from Las Vegas. And now it is so mainstream. You can go to Burger King and get the Beyond
Whopper. It is incredible. You
know? And I think the only reason people resisted going vegetarian or vegan was the inconvenience. Not everybody wanted to find the one health food store in a city that had veggie burgers or have to, you know, now it's become so convenient that it is, and especially during the pandemic, so many people have gone vegan because first off, we're not exercising the way we used to. People are stuck at home. And when you eat shit like that, it has a consequence for your body. And so the boom in vegan eating is just, especially among young people in the past year, it gives me great, great hope.
Well, I have to say, in your book, again, like crazy, one of the things you do is you make so many of these vegan dishes sound absolutely delicious. And I'm thinking that, I don't know if you want to do a cookbook, but some of the recipes that you talk about, especially the ones that you made for Thanksgiving, sound really yummy. So if I ever make it down there, I want to come over and I want you to cook for me.
Absolutely. Love to have you as the guest of honor. Jack, having raised four kids, is a good cook. He cooks more sophisticated things than I do, but between the two of us, we have some phenomenal vegan dinner parties here. And it's great because most of our friends here in Old Town, whether it's Navy friends, shipyard friends, stripper friends, whatever, are not, some of them are vegetarian, a few of them are vegan, many of them are not, but they come over to our vegan dinner parties and it just turns them around. A lot of people have gotten into it because Jack and I were able to show them the ways you can cook these things, which people who grew up with their mother cooking for them, they never really learned how to cook themselves. It just was like too much of an obstacle. And so Jack and I are kind of, we kind of act as vegan mentors to our circle here.
Yeah, I thought about that. You know, there was the point when you go over to get the computer at Easter and they made you the spaghetti bolognese with fake meat. And I thought to myself, God, that's going to be awfully hard for somebody invites you to dinner. Do you have to say, obviously these people knew you, but if you meet somebody and they say, oh, come over for dinner, do you have to let them know, just so you know, I'm a vegetarian, I can bring my own food or you can cook accordingly?
Oh, it's you have to be polite and say that. You can't just show up and they haven't thought about it. And I think nowadays, like especially if I go to like a Thanksgiving or one of Jack's relatives, Jack's ex-wife, for instance, she is not
who comes off so great in this book, by the way.
I love her.
She comes off such a lovely woman. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really a very, very bitter split when he first came
out.
But
the way she meets you and embraces you that first time, that was just great. I didn't expect that at all.
Jack would not allow me to meet his kids or his ex-wife until after we were together a year, because he knew that things had to simmer down. And then things had simmered down, and I think she was glad to see that I wasn't a young twink. And she was really
You're still a twink.
She was glad that I was Jack's age. She was very liked the fact that I had moved my mom in. She's a Latina from a big family. And
very protective of him, which I loved, you know, and also he was really protective of her because he says in the book that he doesn't want to really shove it in her face until she's gotten into a relationship, which I thought was lovely.
Well, that's what's funny about the whole marriage thing is just – and I don't think I put this in the book because there wasn't space, that the day of their divorce, they had to wait enough time so that the bitterness had gone away, and there were no lawyers involved. It was just the two of them, and then I was the witness who could testify that they haven't cohabitated in 5 years, which she was happy with. The day of the divorce court appointment was the day of the case was in Norfolk, gay marriage decision. And so all of our friends were protesting in favor of gay marriage at the courthouse that day. And what are the chances that that's the day that Jack and I and Anna have to walk in for their divorce court proceeding? And we had to walk through our friends going, oh, yeah, you know, we're all here. We're all for gay marriage. But today we're actually here for a straight divorce. So we can't join you. We're going to be inside. And the judge, who was like Mike Tyson, this big guy, high voice, and you know, Jack read his part, Anna read her part, then I read my part. The judge said, I wish this could have been filmed because a lot of couples could learn a lot on how to be civil in these difficult times, as you three have. And I just thought it was too much to bring into the book, all of that, but it was a wonderful scene. It was a wonderful situation to be a part of,
you know. I didn't mention this, but you also mentioned the simpatico between Jack and your mom is that he too had a birth certificate with a lot of missing data, just like her.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Jack, his birth mother, Carol, who is a brilliant writer herself, she got pregnant with Jack in the mid-60s in North Carolina, and her ultra-Catholic parents sent her to Richmond to live in a convent and told friends that she was away with family, as people did back then, and made her give the baby up. She was, I think, 17 or something, 18 at the time. Had her give the baby up and give the baby up for adoption. And she could never hold the baby. She could, and it was just, it was an evil Catholic convent where they just, you know, took these babies. So Jack was adopted by a couple in North Carolina who got divorced after a year. And because they got divorced, the way the
how
law was
ironic.
Back then, had to give him back.
Yeah.
So then he was adopted by a third couple.
And each time the name changed.
Yeah, he was a Dennis. He was a, what's the first one? I can't remember. And then after Dennis, he became Jack. So he had three names by the age of four.
Like your mother.
Like my mother. And then his adopted, final adopted family, the father was a army pilot and was shot down and killed in Vietnam when Jack was like 2 years old. So that
he never had a chance, really, with any of these parents. I mean, ironically, he might have had a better shot if he had stayed with his birth mother.
Right. And his birth mother found him when he turned 18.
Yeah.
And she wrote a book about it called The Other Mother, which is brilliant. Yeah. There was actually a TV
and made
movie.
A movie about it.
Yeah, an NBC movie of the week in the 90s. And somebody from Melrose Place played Jack. The real Jack's cuter.
Jack's a catch, but you're a catch too. I want to say, and I don't want to give it away, but there is a little codicil to this book. Your mom drops a bombshell on you at your uncle's funeral. And because I had already seen you on my MB Alex podcast, I knew what was the upshot of this revelation. It doesn't make it in the book, which I was really upset about. So I'm not going to even tell people what this is about. Read the book and then watch, but don't watch DNN with my MB Alex before. Read the book first, then watch it because you're going to get a surprise you didn't know was coming. It's so great. We have a comment. Lloyd Coleman says, great show as usual, Billy. Well, of course. Living the same life with my mom right now in Arizona. And please tell Dan his book is awesome for those who are beginning the same journey. And I think that, you know, I said this to Paul Rudnick on Tuesday, but Nia Vardalos had told me something when she did the one-woman show that became the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding. I'm from Albanian parents, so Albanian and Greek were very similar, and I identified with it, and she had said to me, but she's heard the same thing from Italian families, from Puerto Rican families, from Indian families, and what she found was the more specific you are, the more universal your story is, and totally. I think that is something that's real, because I read this thinking, well, I love Dan. I'm interested. He's a funny writer, you know, whatever. I didn't know how much I was going to get out of this book until I sat down and read it on that plane coming from Fort Lauderdale. I love it. I just want to show the cover again in a good way, like crazy, Life with My Mom and Her Invisible Friends. Dan, you're a delight. You're always a delight. And I'm so, you know, I'm going to share just this little personal thing, which is that when we talked at Mandalay Bay in Vegas, and we knew who each other was, but we've never really talked. And you said to me when I left, you said, oh, you know, reach out to me on Facebook and, you know, we'll become friends. And that night I got back to the hotel and I went to add you as a friend and we were already friends. And I wrote you and said, I don't know when it happened, Dan, but we're already friends. And I know that I always felt like I knew you through your writing. And I think people who read this are going to be in for a treat and they're going to get to know a little bit more about you. So,
Billy, you're such a sweetheart. Thank you for having
Dan,
me on.
This was a delight. And I'm so glad we've reconnected.
Yes. And let's have dinner when I make it back to LA.
Well, when I make it back, because I'm in Boston because Boston. I came out here with my place in LA is sitting empty. When the pandemic began, I have older parents, a dad who's 88 and a mom who's 79. And I said, what if something happens and they're here alone? And I thought to myself, I should just be out there because as the gay son, You're the one who's free and flexible versus the married sisters. And as it turned out, nobody needed me during this whole pandemic. But I would have felt really horrible if I were cross country. So I'm kind of sitting here saying, oh, when do I get to go back to LA? But I'm kind of glad I've had this year and a half with them. So.
Oh, Boston's awesome. And I think that was obviously the right decision to make.
Yeah, we'll now I need somewhere. Some me time. We will.
We'll run into each other at another hotel concert.
I know, somewhere. some random hotel.
That's how it happens.
I know. Dan, thank you so much. I will be, if you're on for a second when I close, I'll talk to you off stage.
Sure.
But thanks again, everybody. Go out and get his book, Like Crazy. Get it on Amazon, get it on Barnes & Noble, or better yet, as I always say, find a mom and pop bookstore, and if they don't have it, ask them to order it. That way it
thank
gets
you,
on
Billy.
The shelves. I love you, Dan. I'll talk to you later. Too. Everybody else, thank you for watching Billy Masters Live. Next Thursday, we are celebrating Broadway Bears with Jerry Mitchell and some of the really hot guys that are raising money for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. I don't think we're going to have a show next Tuesday because I'm a little tired. So, but next Thursday, definitely. Have a great weekend. Oh my God, there's another comment. Oh, Rocky Durand, thank you for watching. And Steve Masterson, thank you. Have a great weekend wherever you are. Enjoy yourself. Be safe. Be kind. And just remember, you've been watching Billy Masters Live. And if we're here, we're live. Bye, guys.